Before we begin the next chapter, I just want to thank you for all the amazing reviews you've written. They really warm my heart, give me the confidence I need, and help this show find new listeners. So thank you so much. And also thank you to all of my patrons. This show is commercial-free and will remain that way, but you can support my creative process by becoming a patron. Visit sonofelpodcast.com/support. It's only a little bit each month, but it makes a big difference, especially in helping me believe in myself. I love telling this story and appreciate you enabling me to keep telling it. So thank you, and enjoy the show. You're listening to Book 2 of Superman, Son of El. He is more than a story. He is more than a comic book superhero. He is more than a symbol of hope. He represents our greatest aspirations. He is everything we think we can be. And yet, even with all the strength and all the power in all of the world, he may not be able to meet his greatest challenges and redeem his family's legacy. For he is the Son of El. Chapter 16, Braver Than You Think. Before meeting Krypto, Clark had never imagined having a dog. The curious bond the two of them shared was something he felt deeply. Sometimes, Clark joked to himself that he ought to thank Lex Luthor for whatever he had done to make this happen. Despite his concerns that Lex was again practicing some mad science, and as usual was obsessed over Superman, Clark's love for Krypto brushed aside these worries. If anything was bothering Clark, it was his increasing dissatisfaction attending the rotation of sustainability summits he organized around the globe. Ever since talking to Lois about his troubles with writing his next book, Clark had slowly realized how tedious the process of these meetings had become. A sense of futility hung over him, as he received reports detailing how much these countries had once again exceeded his foresting guidelines from the previous year. Clark hid his increasing boredom and sense of futility at these gatherings, but he could see it reflected in Krypto's body language. The dog began each meeting attentive and upright by his side, then progressed to laying his head on Clark's feet. This behavior eventually turned into a few minutes of restless rolling around next to Superman before taking a nap. Clark agreed with Krypto 100% and wished he could do the same. All this while, Clark's mind kept wandering back to his last meeting with Lois. Before then, he was unaware of how bothered he'd become by his own foresting project. Once he had heard himself say it out loud, it was hard to take back the sentiment. As long as Superman was around to replant the forest, what reason did anyone have to sustainably harvest them? These forests were beyond over-harvested well before Clark had even come to Earth. And since then, Superman had helped stabilize the global climate. But in this process, he had made himself a part of an international timber economy. What had started as a hobby had become an industry. Clark couldn't help but suspect that, like any industry, there were probably downstream costs he wasn't seeing. He wondered if the system he had created, and was now sustaining, might be causing grief far beyond the boredom he and his dog suffered. Superman often got to feel like a hero for simply showing up and trying, which wasn't always easy, but sometimes it was easy, and it came with a sense of self-satisfaction. It was a self-rewarding feeling when left unquestioned. But knowing the nature of big business, Clark had a feeling that if he looked into it, he would find someone was suffering due to his efforts to help. That week, he returned to Metropolis to run his idea for his new book by Lois. Krypto whimpered when he learned he had to wait for Clark on the roof of the Daily Planet. But Clark explained that it wouldn't be a good look if he came into his workplace with a dog that looked identical to Superman's dog. Krypto tilted his head, unable to make sense of Clark's concern. But he was a good boy, and waited for Clark while he took care of business. Lois could not have been more enthusiastic to hear Clark's pitch. She was simply beaming.
"Now this is what I'm talking about, Clark. God, I was worried I was going to have to sell that statistical economics book."
"Technically, this is an economics book. I want to thoroughly examine the unintended costs of Superman."
"Yes, I hear you saying that, Clark. But the key word here is Superman."
"I hope that's not the takeaway."
"Oh, it won't be, Clark. It won't be. But this is very brave of you."
"Is it? I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, then don't start now. You can worry about that after the book's done. Clark wasn't quite sure what Lois specifically meant by this remark. This wasn't the first time he had addressed the after effects of being Superman. In the past, when he was a part of some unfortunate wreckage, Clark made sure Superman was a part of the repairs. He felt it was a part of the mending process, both physically and emotionally. As Clark saw it, writing this book was a similar process, but for a slower kind of wreckage. He began his investigation on the ground, as Clark Kent. This was another case he thought it was best he not be seen with a dog people recognized as Superman's. Clark sent Crypto to play in the nearby forests he had cultivated while he talked to the people in the nearby towns. Having grown up with Martha, he knew a thing or two about encouraging a little gossip. Most folks had plenty of troubles and needed someone to vent to about them. Asking around, Clark heard a litany of miserable experiences. Among them, he saw two recurring themes. First, though the new timber industry in these areas was considered an economic boon and brought with it urban development, most of the people Clark spoke to were desperately struggling to keep up with the cost of living in their expanding cities. The second recurring tragedy Clark witnessed was the result of the many new wood mills cropping up along with the foresting industry. Many of these mills often left their workers maimed. They operated with little safety regulation, let alone guidelines. In each country Clark investigated, he found the same power dynamics. A limited few families owned the land and made deals with corporations. The sizable profits of their seemingly magically renewed resource accumulated while Superman offset the cost. He wished it could be so simple as to halt his role in the matter, but knew that should he stop, the forest would likely dwindle to their previous size and the climate would lose what stability it had gained. After completing his interviews with workers, ex-workers, and those disenfranchised, Clark summoned his dog. He whistled for Crypto in a high pitch that only the dog could hear, and the two of them headed home. While Clark attempted to sort his experience into something to write about, Crypto watched on, wondering what they would do next. Looking back on the first draft of his writing, Clark wondered the same. It seemed as though, no matter his effort or intention, Superman's help contributed to someone else's suffering down the line. One late morning, while this dilemma stared at him from his written page, Clark decided it was a good moment to take a break. In the house, Martha was busy in the kitchen, prepping Linda's cake for her third birthday, happening the following day. She instantly dialed in on Clark's body language.
"What's going on, Clark? What's got you so down?"
He explained to her the line of thinking his writing was taking him down. She listened as he rambled and finally concluded,
"But I keep asking myself, what do I do next? I mean, I'll keep writing this book, but in the meantime, Superman has to do something to help these people. These companies are dangerous and need regulation, but I don't know how that's done. If I do it myself, pretty soon these factories will be relying on Superman to keep repairing them, just like they keep relying on Superman to keep replanting the forests. And at this point, I can't even stop planting the trees or I'd probably hurt even more people. It seems like the more I help, the less they do to help themselves."
Clark sighed and dropped his head. Martha stopped what she was doing and sat down with him at the table.
"You know, Clark, this makes me think of a story I like to remind myself of from time to time. What's that boat? The one where all the planks of wood are replaced, but it's the same boat all along?"
"The ship of Theseus?"
"The ship of Theseus, that's the one. Sometimes when I look at all the problems in the world, I think of the ship of Theseus. I think about what it would be like to be one of those planks on that ship."
Clark raised an eyebrow at this proposal. Martha noticed, raising a hand.
"Now hold on, bear with me. What I mean is that each one of those planks is only part of that ship for a little while, and one day they'll each be replaced. And in that way, humanity is like that ship. We're all just a single plank of wood amongst countless other planks, making up a great big boat. And when you're just a little old plank on a boat with the waves of the sea crashing against you, you want to believe someone's steering that boat. And believe me, those planks are praying to God that God indeed has taken the helm to guide humanity through our troubled waters. And now here it is. You're trying to answer those prayers and steer that boat. But it's not so simple, now is it?
No, it really isn't. It's starting to feel like the more I try, the more the boat drags itself down.
It's funny you should mention that, because I was thinking, we hear people asking why God doesn't answer our prayers, but I think we may just be seeing the answer to that question. If God came down and fixed every one of our problems, we'd all probably fall back on our worst tendencies. It seems to me the best thing a plank on a ship can do is hold fast and try to be the best little plank it can be. With a little self-discipline and a whole lot of support, well, that's how we maintain ourselves and ensure we aren't letting in any water that might damage the other planks around us. All of us planks may feel powerless to steer this ship, yet at the same time, it seems that if too many of us are rowed and start letting water into the boat, we'll steer ourselves to the bottom of the sea.
Well, that's a frightening thought.
It's not as dire as it sounds. This boat we call humanity has been sailing with plenty of cracks this whole time, and we somehow get by. It turns out, Clark, that God is the tide, and the boat is carried just fine. You don't have to worry about steering this ship. You're just another plank, like the rest of us.
Martha's words struck the right chord in Clark, though the last bit was something of a riddle. It felt to Clark that as this metaphor went, he carried more responsibility than an average plank. Nonetheless, on the other side of Linda's birthday, Clark was finally writing his book with intent. He was restructuring it around Martha's boat analogy. Even though he was capable of typing with super speed, Clark slowly plodded away through drafts of the book with deep introspection. Crypto eventually got bored of Clark's writing habit and began taking himself out, patrolling the forests he regularly visited with Superman. Instinctually, Crypto knew to transform into his cape before leaving. Clark trusted his dog to behave himself while he polished his book into its final draft. In the end, he concluded by suggesting that Superman's arrival in the world was a miracle that could become a curse if we neglect to be our best selves. He challenged his readers to do more than simply be the best plank on the boat they could be. He asked everyone to look around at the planks nearby them, the ones having trouble weathering the storms, and instead of judging them, he suggested they fortify themselves to give those planks someone stable to hold on to. Clark suggested that every plank on the boat of humanity was not the same, but each could contribute in their own individual ways. He, Clark Kent, a reporter, was being the best plank he could be in the way that he knew how, by writing his books. Before summer came, Clark submitted the book to Lois with the title, Superman Can't Save Us. Again, Lois emphasized Clark's bravery, but he dismissed the suggestion. This was the least he could do. That summer, Bruce and Damian visited for the third year in a row. Like the previous day, Damian returned more aloof than before, especially toward his father. When Bruce showed him any discipline, the response was soaked in either disdain or sarcasm.
Don't worry, Bat Dad. We're only gonna burn down the world.
Clark almost commented, but thought better of it. Once Damian and the twins had escaped the company of the adults, Clark and Bruce found a moment to talk as they watched Linda play fetch with Crypto. Clark was compelled to jest.
How long have you been going by Bat Dad?
For about 2 minutes now. That was his first attempt trying it out. Thanks for not reacting. Maybe it'll be the last we hear of it, as long as you don't start repeating it.
Though he was tempted to extend the bit, Clark pivoted the conversation for Bruce's sake.
How's the training going?
Not well, obviously. He thinks he knows everything already.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you know it, but that's pretty normal for his age. I had a short week where I felt that way, before I blasted out the broadside of the barn trying to prove I could control my strength.
Bruce shook his head with a breathy chuckle, exhaling through his nose.
I guess I should consider myself lucky he doesn't have powers. Sounds like you're in for it with Joseph and Jerome.
Clark swallowed a lump in his throat. This friendly tease almost felt like a threat, but not one coming from Bruce. Clark brushed the thought away with a little saying he had learned from Martha.
I'm sure they'll figure it out for themselves when the time comes. They're good kids. They're smart, and they try to do what's right, so I trust them. I'm sure the same goes for Damian.
Bruce took a long, slow breath before responding.
Your optimism is endearing, Clark, but you might not be saying that if you saw him in action. When I say that he thinks he already knows everything, what makes it frustrating is that he almost does. The League of Shadows trained him well. If I wasn't there to stop him, I would say he's among the most deadly assassins they've yet created.
Yikes. It's that bad?
Again, Bruce paused, casting his eyes down and looking inward. While his friend gathered his thoughts, Clark appreciated Linda and Crypto's game. The little girl could not throw the stick nearly as far as Crypto would prefer, but the dog made a theatrical display of prancing to fetch the stick. Bruce let out a deep sigh. At the very least, I can say he's obedient. It seems the only thing that stops him from striking a killing blow is that he knows I've forbidden it. I don't know precisely what training Ra's al Ghul gave him, but this one point seems to have been driven in, above all else. Since giving him the mantle of Robin, the boy obeys me.
I wouldn't have guessed it by the way he talks.
It's how he compensates for the obedience trained into him.
Well, that and it's normal at his age to test some boundaries.
Clark was glad he and Bruce found that moment to talk on the first day of their visit. The next 2 days flew by as Drew and Martha had an array of activities planned for the family. During their stay, Damien complained several times about the camping they were doing along their trip. The visit was cut short when Bruce received a call. He summoned his Batwing, and he and Damien departed within the hour. As they boarded his jet, Bruce looked back at Clark.
You can keep the van. Maybe take the family camping.
Jerry and Joey watched in awe at the sleek black jet their friend boarded, though they were more impressed by the idea of a camping trip. Damien had sounded miserable describing camping to them, but his stories captivated the boys, and over the next few weeks, conversations around the Kent household became centered around planning a family camping trip. Yet during those weeks of planning, Clark's attention was divided. Lois had Clark making small last-minute revisions to his book before it went into print. She wanted him to reorder a few chapters and cite a few sources. In the meantime, Superman began his efforts to get ahead of this book and see what he could do to help the people suffering in these unregulated lumber mills. His first strategy was to simply show up and inspect the mills in person. To the astonishment of the managers and workers alike, he wrote them citations for their safety violations and told them he would return, expecting them to do better. Not sure how this approach would go over, he only tried it with one mill at first. Returning the following week, Clark found most of his citations had been addressed, and the workers approved his arrival. It was encouraging, though Clark didn't want to show his own approval too soon. He took a page from Batman's example, keeping his face stern, despite the impressive progress. Before leaving, he thanked them, yet warned he would come back. Being disingenuous didn't feel right, but again, the following week, the results were apparent. This was evidence enough for Clark to expand his inspection practice, though he wanted to minimize it, hoping the reputation of a surprise visit from Superman would be enough to encourage factory managers to shape up before he showed up. All appeared to be going as planned until, on his second visit to one of these mills, his arrival was met by anxious workers. They averted their eyes from Superman as the manager defiantly explained that his citations had been incorrect and that in their country, they were up to regulation. Superman retorted that he had his own standards and he expected them to be met. Yet Clark was interrupted while giving this explanation when he noticed a nervous employee on the brink of being caught by a giant blade. Bolting away from his argument with the mill manager, Superman caught the blade as it painfully nicked the worker's arm. Despite this heroism, the manager erupted at Superman for having destroyed the machine. This all happened the same week before the Kent family camping trip and in the final days before the debut of Clark's book. Clark looked forward to leaving it all behind for a few weeks. They packed the camping pod, long ago provided by Ray Palmer, with all of their food and supplies. Then, for the first time, Clark used the shrinking function that Ray had built into the 3-bedroom pod. The entire thing reduced itself to a capsule. Clark put it in his pocket, and the rest of the family loaded into their new van. Lana, Linda, Martha, Pete, Drew, and the twins. Though they were a bit cramped, the trip wouldn't be long. Clark transformed, lifting them above his head as he carried them to the valley he had once spent his summer in as a teenager. Crypto flew alongside him. The children were ecstatic, though Lana was concerned about the wild animals. Clark's assurance didn't come out quite right.
They're mostly friendly, except for the occasional rabid wolverine.
Lana knew the story from Clark's youth, and though she put her hands on her hips and rolled her eyes as a tease, with a single smile, she reminded Clark that he had come a long way since that crushing day in his teens. It was good to see that he could joke about it all these years later. Clark cleared out a space near a meadow and expanded the capsule back into a camping pod.
Cutting the work for everyone, he dashed around setting up the campsite's kitchen, washing area, table, chairs, and even a string of lights for ambiance. When it was complete, the others took over the cooking while he and Lana hung out with the kids. Clark thought this would be the perfect time to show them around.
Who wants to go see the river?
Cheers all around followed them to the nearby riverbank. The pathway was a bit rough, and Clark suspected he ought to do something about it to make the walk easier for Martha. At the shore, they came to a wide, shallow area of the river with a swim hole not too far downstream. Joey looked up at his father with concern on his face.
But we don't know how to swim.
Clark smiled, looking down at his son.
That's all right. I didn't know either when I first came here.
His father's words and warm smile eased his worries. However, the boys were too nervous to try swimming that first day. Instead, along with their sister, they found the many stones on the shore to be an endless source of entertainment. Clark agreed. The stones were just what he needed to pave a path up to the campsite. Pete came down this finished pathway to the river carrying a basket of sandwiches for all. Martha and Drew soon followed. After eating, Pete taught the boys how to skip stones, and pretty soon everyone was skipping them. Clark had to remind Crypto not to fetch the rocks. For one of his turns skipping a stone, Clark went a bit too far and released it with a crack, cutting into the shore across from them. This prompted the boys to start throwing with all their might, resulting in flailing rocks with no skip to them whatsoever. The land around the campsite was wild, with animal trails traveling through the nearby meadow. In that space, Clark built the boys a makeshift goal to kick their ball around. When Linda insisted they play with her as well, they took some time to teach her how to catch a pass and pass it back, just enough so that they could pretend to include her in their drills. It was the perfect pastime for the kids while the adults prepared dinner. The family barbecued each evening, though the days were not long this far to the north, and they barely used the string of lights Clark had put up. Each week being progressively hotter than the last led to more time down on the river. With a little encouragement and supervision, Clark helped his kids become comfortable in the water. It was slow progress at first, but by the time the family was packing to head home, the boys were getting the fundamentals, and even Linda was doggy paddling along with Crypto. On their last night camping, everyone was delighted to see Kara arrive to join them for dinner. She had barely vented about the Justice League International when asked how she was doing, but changed the subject to more tantalizing news.
Your new book is certainly causing some waves.
Oh? Good waves, I hope.
All kinds of waves. It's a bestseller, so congratulations.
Already? That seems fast.
Well, you're the one who decided to write an exposé on Superman. You must have known this would stir the pot of public opinion.
Of course I did. But I thought the book was more about all of us. Like, humanity. That's the pot I was trying to stir.
First off, I don't think you and I count as humanity.
Sure we do. Don't be absurd.
And second of all, the book has Superman right there in the title.
It's called Superman Can't Save Us. The book is about us.
Okay, well, it doesn't look like anyone got the memo.
After returning home, Clark was relieved to see Kara's words proved to be mostly hyperbolic. Though it was true there were some especially loud critics of Superman citing his book, Clark felt they were a minority. He could not bring himself to take them seriously, as most of these people sounded as though they had not read his book beyond its title. If anything, Clark was encouraged to hear Lex Luthor's response. It was measured, to say the least, and Clark thought he might dare call it positive. When asked to comment, Luthor's answer was curt.
I have read the book, and I am still taking it in. It has a lot to say. Very powerful writing.
Just as Clark suspected, Lois was eager to get him on a promotional tour. It was at these promotional events that the impact of his writing started to dawn on Clark. His speaking engagements and book signings were consistently attended by people holding up signs. Their slogans were of all sorts, and it was clear they were not all together. The signs could read anything from, "Hold Superman accountable," and, "Save yourself," or, "No justice like human justice," right next to, "One vote, one people." After fighting broke out at more than one of his book signings, Clark thought it better he dial back the promotional appearances. He didn't have any worries for himself, but he believed they were creating a volatile situation, dangerous for everyone attending. Most of the people reading his books and attending these events were not fanatical, and had no part in these disputes. Clark wanted no one hurt, especially these innocent bystanders. Lois agreed to stop the tour, and book sales only went up as word of the controversy spread. She was undeniably impressed.
You've really outdone yourself, Clark. This thing is a juggernaut. We're already planning the next print run. Though man oh man, you have struck a chord in every wacko community imaginable.
I prefer to think I've struck a chord with a lot of people, and it's bound to include a few, as you call them, wackos.
No, you definitely have more than your fair share.
I just hope they're actually reading the book.
With his promotional calendar canceled, Clark enjoyed the break it gave him. He returned to his gardening full-time, needing to organize a new wave of tree planting. Resenting the economic role he was stuck in did nothing to lessen his love for plants. In his arboretum, Clark could forget about the turbulence his writing had caused. He imagined it shouldn't be too long before enough people took the time to read this new book and understand his message. In the meantime, he reminded himself he only need worry about his family, his plants, and his dog, though Crypto increasingly explored the world during the day without him, checking in on Clark's trees worldwide. Crypto had grown to become very much his own person. At the end of summer, the twins began fourth grade, and Linda started preschool. Clark was the one to bring her to school on the morning of her first day. She was surprisingly okay being left with the other kids her age, running off with them after a distracted goodbye. Pride in his daughter's adaptability and open-mindedness distracted Clark as he briefly checked in with the daycare teacher, signed Linda in, and made his way out to his van in the parking lot. He was hardly paying attention when he was approached by a man wearing a trench coat and a fedora. The man spoke in a gruff, hushed voice.
Clark Kent.
What can I do for you?
I've read your book. Very provocative.
Clark looked toward the mysterious man, but had trouble making out his face.
Do I know you?
Not yet, Mr. Kent. But I believe we can help each other.
He walked up to Clark, handing him a business card. Clark again looked at the man's face, and again was unsure what he was seeing. No features of his face could properly be discerned. The card he handed to Clark simply read, "The Question." In one corner was a phone number, and across from it was an email. The man looked around before drawing a piece of paper from his pocket.
"This isn't a safe place to talk, but I've got information for you."
Clark took the scrap of paper from him. Scribbled on it were two names Clark didn't recognize. The mysterious fellow began walking away. Clark called after him.
Are these names supposed to mean something to me?
The man stopped, looking back over his shoulder.
It will all make sense tomorrow.
With no further elaboration, the faceless man in a trench coat turned away and walked off. Clark felt no sense of immediate threat, yet he was unnerved. This mystery man knew where and when to find him that morning, on the first day of his daughter's preschool. Clark wondered if this was what Lois meant when she said he was especially brave for writing this book. Publishing it was bringing Clark a whole nother level of attention that he wasn't sure he wanted. Thank you for listening. I'm Isaac Bluefoot. Book 2 of Son of El is written and independently produced by myself. I've been telling the story for nearly decades now, and I really appreciate sharing it with you. This podcast is a commercial-free endeavor and fueled by my passion. You can bolster that passion by becoming a patron at sonofelpodcast.com/support. Thank you to all of my patrons. The little bit you give makes a big difference, especially at warming my heart. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. This story was inspired by the Superman and DC comics and characters originally created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, with additional contributions by Otto Binder, Kurt Swan, Jim Mooney, Bill Finger, Bob Kane, Mike W. Barr, Grant Morrison, Andy Kubert, Julius Schwartz, Gardner Fox, Gil Kane, Al Plastino, and Steve Ditko. Music in this episode was made by Dr. Sparkles, Mellow C, Blue Dot Sessions, Correspondence, Poddington Bear, Mr. Smith, Chad Crouch, Crowender, and Soft and Furious. See the episode notes for details.
And be sure to listen to the next episode. Chapter 17. Ask the Right Questions.